This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Joining me on the Jodcast today is Dr. Graham Smith of the University of Birmingham. Graham is working on a survey of the local cluster of galaxies. So, Graham, would you like to tell us some about this survey you're producing?
Yes, so we're observing a large sample of galaxy clusters, approximately 100, and we're observing them with a wide range of telescopes, all the way from radio wavelengths through to X-ray. And the reason why we're doing this is to figure out the best way to measure the mass of galaxy clusters. This is important because galaxy clusters are claimed to be very powerful probes of cluster cosmology, in particular to try to measure the properties of dark energy that is driving the current accelerating expansion of the universe. And if we don't understand how to measure the mass of a galaxy cluster, then such experiments will ultimately not work.
So how do you go about measuring the mass of these clusters of galaxies?
Well, there are several methods available. The one that I particularly concentrate on myself is to use a phenomenon known as gravitational lensing. So in general terms, gravitational lensing is the deflection of light by mass. So if you imagine a galaxy cluster, so this is a collection of galaxies that are all sort of orbiting around together in the same region of space, and behind this galaxy cluster you have what you could imagine as a cosmic wallpaper, as it were, lots of faint galaxies at higher redshifts behind the cluster.
By redshift you mean distance. I'm looking back into the past here.
Of course I do, yes, that's right. So these more distant, the light from these more distant galaxies is deflected by the mass content of the foreground galaxy cluster, and their shapes are subtly changed by this deflection by the foreground cluster mass. And so I measure these faint galaxy shapes, and from the statistics of their shapes, I can build computer models of the mass in these clusters. And this method has a variety of advantages and disadvantages. The strongest advantage is that we don't need to make any assumption about the physics of galaxy clusters in order to make the mass measurement.
What do you mean by the physics of galaxy clusters?
What I mean by that is the easiest way to explain that is to talk about an alternative method in which you do need to make such, you do need to worry about the physics. So in general, other methods rely on direct observations of the content of the galaxy cluster itself. And so this is achieved through, say, X-ray observations of the gas that lives inside the cluster or the starlight from the galaxies in the cluster. Although we can make these observations, the mass of a galaxy cluster is dominated by what we call dark matter, which doesn't emit any light. And so to estimate the mass of a galaxy cluster from observations of the luminous content, you need to make an assumption about how the luminous content of the cluster traces the underlying dark matter. And that's what I mean by physics, as in we don't really understand the physics of the interplay between dark matter and luminous matter in clusters. So that also points at a kind of complementary aspect of the survey, which is to get a better handle on the physics of that interplay between dark and luminous matter.
You said earlier that measuring the mass mm-hmm. of those galaxy clusters can give information on dark energy.
Mm-hmm.
Can you first tell us what dark energy is, and maybe after that tell us how do you go from the mass of those clusters sure. to information on dark energy?
Okay, so back in the 90s, astronomers realized that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. And before that, we thought that the expansion was just gradually slowing down under the influence of gravity. And essentially, the current expansion rate of the universe is a competition between gravity pulling stuff back towards you and the initial impulse provided from the Big Bang. And yet, distant supernovae, exploding stars, were discovered to be fainter and therefore further away than was previously thought. And therefore, the universe must have expanded more, from which you infer this accelerating expansion. In very broad terms, the physics that's responsible for this accelerating expansion is referred to as dark energy. There are a variety of theories as to what exactly what that physics is, and there's huge efforts to try and pin down that physics, actually understand it. So if you take a universe that is expanding and that expansion is accelerating, that makes distant objects fainter and dimmer than would be in a universe that isn't accelerating. But also that accelerating expansion literally pushes stuff further away from other stuff, right? So by stuff, I mean like the matter that clumps together to form galaxy clusters.
It's like when we talk about the cookie and the resins on the cookie, where everything is expanding and everything goes further away.
Yes, that's right. So galaxy clusters form what we refer to as hierarchically. In other words, smaller galaxy systems like galaxy groups, they merge together to form bigger systems that we refer to as galaxy clusters. If the expansion of the universe is accelerating, then that acceleration is pushing the kind of the subunits, if you like, that ultimately merge together to form the galaxy cluster further away, and therefore it takes longer. The period of assembly of galaxy clusters becomes more protracted. And so then how does the mass of galaxy clusters relate to all of that? You can measure the mass of one galaxy cluster. Well, that doesn't tell you very much. It tells you about that galaxy cluster. But if you can measure the mass of a large sample of galaxy clusters, a number, you know, say 100 or so, and plot a histogram. So this is literally a question of measuring a histogram of galaxy cluster masses in the local universe and also in the distant universe. And comparing those two histograms and from that getting constraints on dark energy.
What do you mean by local universe and distant universe?
So by distant universe, I mean when the universe was roughly half of its current age. Technical terms, you know, a redshift of 1. So this is 6.5 billion years ago or so. And what I mean by the local universe is more like, say, 2 billion years ago.
Can you apply this method of gravitational lensing to clusters of galaxies at a greater distance?
Yes, you can. There are limits, though. So currently, I'm studying galaxy clusters at what we refer to as a look-back time of 2 billion years, and the galaxies that are behind these clusters are the light's traveled for 6.5 billion years to get to us and pass through the foreground mass in these clusters. It would be very interesting to apply similar methods to measure the mass of galaxy clusters that are at a similar look-back time to exactly those galaxies that we're using to make the measurement on the local clusters. That points to a problem in that we need to apply this method to study clusters at great distances. We need to get much deeper, much more sensitive data in order to measure these galaxies that are still further away behind the more distant clusters. So there will be limits to how far we can apply these methods.
By using this two-pronged approach in your survey of X-ray and the weak lensing, the X-ray gives you a measure of the baryonic mass, so the mass that we're comprised of, I'm guessing.
Yes.
And the weak lensing gives you a total mass of the galaxy, including the dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
How do these compare to each other? Are you getting a lot more baryonic matter, or is the dark matter dominating significantly?
The dark matter dominates. Yeah, in a word, yes. And an interesting quantity to measure is the baryon fraction. In other words, you divide the mass of a cluster that's in the form of ordinary matter like us, divide that by the total mass that includes all of the dark matter. And we get fractions of, you know, of order 15%, which is entirely consistent with other observations and with theoretical expectations.
And how does your survey link into the evolution of galactic groups and galaxies?
One of the key things that will come out of this survey, that's called the Local Cluster Substructure Survey, is that we will basically provide a sort of a low redshift, a local universe sort of baseline study of galaxy clusters. And so this will make this sample of clusters a kind of reference study against which galaxy clusters at higher redshifts, you know, greater distances, against which they can be compared, and that'll help astronomers in the future to interpret and understand the measurements that they'll make on big samples of clusters in the future.
Okay, and you mentioned at the beginning that you use also clusters to infer the physics of large-scale structure.
Mm-hmm.
Can you maybe talk a bit more about that?
Yes, of course. So on the one hand, measuring the kind of cluster mass measurements that I've talked about so far, mass measurements made on quite large scales, so we're trying to really estimate the total mass of a galaxy cluster. And that's really useful if you want to try to constrain cosmological parameters, as I've just discussed earlier. On the other hand, it's also interesting to measure the mass of a galaxy cluster on very small scales, right in the central regions, for example. And so by comparing the mass measurements you get from gravitational lensing on very small scales in clusters with the mass measurements that you get from X-ray data on the same small scales, and seeing how well they agree, basically dividing the lensing mass by the X-ray mass, and you might hope the answer is 1, that the two agree, but if they don't agree, then that's a signature of other physics, right? Physics beyond the assumptions that you need to make in order to get the X-ray mass. So what you assume to make the X-ray mass measurements is that the gas in the cluster that is emitting the X-rays is in equilibrium with the underlying mass distribution that you're probing with the gravitational lensing. If they're not in equilibrium, then you get an answer that's different from one when you divide the two mass measurements.
So basically what you're saying is that with the X-ray, it's a way of testing the physics we use to infer the total mass from the X-ray.
Yes.
By comparing it with the total mass measured from weak lensing.
That's right, yeah. Yes. And so by making these comparisons on small scales, potentially we can get constraints on the strength of magnetic fields in the centers of galaxy clusters, or constraints on cosmic rays and such like, potentially also constraints on rotation of galaxy clusters. It's very easy, you know, when looking at the night sky through a very big telescope, to forget the fact that the possibility that galaxy clusters and similar systems may actually be rotating, for example.
How massive is a typical cluster?
That's a really good question. So the simplest thing to say is that galaxy clusters are the most massive objects in the universe, right? And order of magnitude, the most massive clusters weigh 10 to the power 15 times more than our sun. So that's one with 15 zeros. And I've tried for a while to come up with a nice analogy, you know, to help particularly members of the public get their head around, you know, these kind of scales within physics that we deal with day to day. So what kind of comparison can I make between, you know, something that's really tiny and every day and something that's larger and every day? But the problem is that the numbers are just so big, right? And I haven't come up with one yet. So you kind of just think of a huge, unimaginable number.
How about in terms of mass of the Milky Way, for example?
To compare with the mass of the Milky Way, then say 10,000 times more than the mass of the Milky Way. 10 to 100,000 times more. Yeah, so the Milky Way isn't quite an everyday object, but yeah, it helps. It helps.
And do you have an idea of how big a volume these clusters of galaxies encompass?
The typical radius of these galaxy clusters is of order a few million light years. For a photon to travel from one side of one of these galaxy clusters to another might take, you know, of order 5 million years.
Can you find anything about the individual galaxies in these clusters from your survey?
Yes. So in addition to what I've been describing so far, we're also observing a lot of these clusters with the Herschel Space Observatory. So this is a new observatory, a new satellite that ESA, the European Space Agency, put in space a couple of years ago now. And this satellite is operating in what's known as the far infrared, so wavelengths between 100 and 500 microns. So this is effectively observing heat from these galaxies. The reason why that's interesting is that a typical galaxy that lives in a galaxy cluster is what we refer to as red and dead. In other words, not forming many stars and doesn't contain much gas or dust. And yet a typical galaxy that doesn't live in a galaxy cluster is, well, I suppose the opposite of red and dead in these terms is blue and alive, I suppose, in that it's forming stars. It's typically a spiral galaxy like our Milky Way. And somehow, like I mentioned earlier, galaxy clusters form hierarchically, like smaller galaxy systems, individual galaxies merge together to form clusters that are these huge beasts, if you like. Somehow, these blue disk galaxies change into these red dead galaxies in the centers of galaxy clusters. And we already know that some of the galaxies that make this journey from being blue and alive to red and dead go through a period of increased star formation. And if the increase in star formation, that's in the kind of death throes, as it were, in going towards being red and dead, if that enhanced period of star formation is sufficiently intense, then these galaxies produce a lot of dust. And this dust absorbs the ultraviolet radiation from these young stars and re-emits it in what we refer to as the far infrared. In other words, re-emits it as what we think of as heat. And so Herschel is a fantastic machine for finding such galaxies and measuring their properties. And so we're doing a big survey of these relatively nearby clusters to find such galaxies in these clusters and to try to disentangle. There's a wide range of physics that could be responsible for the properties of these galaxies. We're trying to disentangle these different possibilities and actually learn.
What you're saying, I'm not sure I understood perfectly, but that those blue and alive galaxies mm-hmm. become red and then by falling into the cluster or being accreted into the cluster, or is it?
Yes.
Okay.
In a word. Yes.
So in this process of merging, will they just falling in?
Well, that's...
It triggers a star formation, which causes the morphology of the galaxy to change.
Yep, that's one of the possibilities, yes. Yeah.
Could that happen to our Milky Way?
Yeah, so that's a really nice way of thinking about this. In that context, the Milky Way lives in what we know as the local group. So it's like a little group of galaxies. So some of your listeners may be familiar with M31 or the Andromeda Galaxy. So these are two blue and alive disk galaxies in a little group with lots of other little satellites. And this group lives in the outskirts of a galaxy cluster known as the Virgo Cluster. And one day, this local group of galaxies that we live in will ultimately fall into the Virgo Cluster, and potentially the Milky Way will go through a period of elevated star formation, maybe sufficiently intense to make it a much dustier environment, and its infrared luminosity would the heat that it emits would therefore go up. You know, maybe it's detectable by astronomers on the other side of the universe pointing their equivalent of the Herschel Space Observatory in our direction in the future.
In clusters of galaxies, you see a lot more elliptical shapings, or S0 class galaxies, so ellipticals with a sort of disk around them, compared to ones in just the field.
Yeah.
Is this also caused by the merging and falling in?
That's all part of the same story, yeah. So, so by red and dead, I'm referring to elliptical and S0 or lenticular galaxies. Yeah, that's right. Presumably, there is a relationship between these S0 galaxies, they do have a disk, but there's no star formation going on in it, and the disk galaxy, the blue and alive disk spiral galaxies that fell in. And so how does that star formation turn off is one way of posing the question.
I guess, Graham, thank you for telling us about your survey of clusters of galaxies and merging and taking us a tour of the wider universe. So thank you for joining us on the Jodcast. It's been great.
Thank you.
Thanks.